listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 406.
Hello and welcome once again to The Outdoor Station, online, on internet radio, on smartphones, on smart TV, on Now TV, on Apple TV, and on iTunes all around the world. Yes, the list continues to grow as The Outdoor Station continues to reach networks other podcasts cannot. The latest news from us is that we have had an offer accepted on a new property. And if all goes to plan, the new studio construction will start fairly rapidly, ready for the next stage in our evolution. To keep abreast of this development, do please take a few moments to visit the Outdoor Station website and sign up for our newsletter section, where you can also make some suggestions as to future content you would like to see or hear more about. Now, one person who has done this is Mark Cole, and he also visited our support page and made a very generous financial contribution to our running costs via the PayPal donate button. Now, the deal here is if you make such a financial donation of support, we, in return, make you an executive producer of some podcasts as our way of saying thank you, Mark. So, the executive producer of podcast number 406 and 407, a two-parter, is Mark Cole. And our thanks go along with that. In spring 2016, David Broome, an ecologist by profession, who describes himself as a hill walker with a passion for open landscapes, multi-day trips and wild camping in some of the most remote areas of the UK, set off to run the length of the Outer Hebrides, the remote chain of islands off of Scotland's northwest coast, from Barra in the south to the Butt of Lewis in the north. Part one of his story now follows, and I do suggest you visit the Outdoor Station website for the pictures and a small video he's made to go with it. It'll give you much more atmosphere to go along with the audio you're about to listen to. So sit back, relax, and start dreaming of wild, open places.
Well, there are two reasons, really. It's really to fulfil two ambitions that I've had for some time. One is to have this unsupported solo trip from the southernmost end of the Outer Hebrides right up to the very north, visiting as much of the sort of wild, remote landscape as I can. So that would fulfil an ambition I've had since I was a teenager, when I first had the pleasure of visiting the Outer Hebrides. And then the second reason for the trip is for me to use this as a way of raising sponsorship donation money for the John Muir Trust, which is, well, for people with an interest that we all share, an interest in these fantastic, wild, remote places. They are one of the most important interest groups we have, really, because they look after our wild places. They keep an eye on major development projects that might detract from the quality of the wild places that we visit. They own some of the most iconic wild landscapes in Scotland and manage those areas, in my opinion, fantastically well in terms of nature conservation and opportunities for visiting them, you know, for recreational visits as well, with footpath management and this sort of thing. So yeah, really, really important charity for the areas that we all really need to visit. It's not just a luxury, is it? It's good for us to go to these places. So those are the reasons, really.
And the preparation for something like this, then, now we've pulled the maps out, first of all, I'm surprised it actually covered, what, five, six OS maps, which is quite interesting. Yeah. What did you refer to them as you pulled the maps out? They're saying they were dangerous maps?
These are dangerous documents. They're dangerous documents because if you've never really looked at maps of the Outer Hebrides in any sort of detail, then I think there's a very good chance that you spend a few minutes looking at these maps and all sorts of fantastic adventures will start to crop up in your head and you will want to keep going back time after time after time. So if you have an opportunity to look at maps of the Outer Hebrides, do make sure you've got plenty of time for what will happen next, which will be a whole sequence of fantastic holidays.
Okay, well, we take no responsibility for what happens next. So we can set the scene, tell us about the time of year that you did this and obviously your jumping off point.
Well, I chose to do this trip in May. A couple of reasons for that. One, my job, I'm an ecologist, and I knew that in May, these islands have many riches to offer in terms of the vegetation that's just coming into flower, the breeding birds that are just coming down into these areas, and also the dreaded Hebridean midge is at its least grim in May, and also the weather it calms down in the spring. It's quite a kind time of year in terms of weather. I've been up to this area in sort of high summer, and it's not just the midges that can be a nuisance. It can actually get some quite lively weather systems coming through. So for a trip like this, that was quite an important consideration because I was doing this as a solo trip and I really had to get this done within a fairly sort of tight time window, so I couldn't really afford to lose too much time to bad weather.
Well, what was your approach? How did you approach this trip? Were you sort of self-supported or are you looking to do food drops or call in to see friends or what?
No, it's totally self-supported. It's very much an extension of the sort of two-day mountain marathon style of trips that I've done for many, many years now. And I saw this as a way of using those sort of skills and experiences and just extending the skills and the fitness and the kit and everything that you would use on a trip like that to a trip of my own design. But it's very much self-supported. I did originally think about sending food parcels up to sort of obliging hotels and B&Bs and things, but what I chose to do instead was to carry enough food for maybe 2 or 3 days at a time, and then I would drop down out of the hills into a shop, and I would stock up for the next couple of days. So it's a small contribution to the local economy, very modest, but and also just a chance to sort of have a chat to a few people and rehumanize, if you like, which.
Well, I can't imagine you were actually spoiled for choice with shopping centres and multi-complex cinemas experiences.
No, but after a few days of this sort of trip, your threshold of human contact lowers somewhat. So just chatting to the lady in the co-op becomes quite a rich experience.
To recap then, you're looking at doing this as a sort of fairly lightweight trip from a practical point of view, not carrying too much for obvious reasons. You've got some fairly serious hills to climb. What sort of pace were you giving yourself? Were you trying to, and the time scale for the whole thing as well?
Well, the time scale, it was quite difficult to try and be too predictive on this. So I started off by breaking the route down. The total length of the route is just over 250 kilometres, and the height gain totals up at over 10,000 metres, which was quite a surprise. No Munros or anything up here. There's one hill which is very nearly a Munro, but there are so many smaller hills with big drops between them, that the accumulated height gain is over 10,000 metres. So to start off with, I had a go at breaking the journey down into days. I approached it as a run, as a mountain run, but probably never much more of an average pace of about 6K an hour, something like that.
Oh, so you did it at sort of a fair pace then? Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you approached it adventure racing style, jog, sort of jog the downs and slog up the ups?
Yeah, that's definitely, it's sort of speedy walking on the way up jogging along the ridges, which is just superb, the best. And then the descents, most of the descents were runnable. Some of the descents needed a little more care because the geology creates these sort of stepped rock faces. Mm. So there was need to be careful there. And careful I was, because obviously I'm doing this thing solo, I wanted to finish the event. I wasn't out to ruin myself. I was out to finish the experience. So, on that basis, it sort of broke down to about 9 or 10 days. I think in the end it took me 11 days. I was slowed up. I had to sit one day out in a bothy because the weather was just suicidal for a day. So I thought the sensible thing is just to sit that one out. It worked pretty well, really, because after having spent quite a lot of years doing various sort of forms of hill walking and mountaineering and these adventure race events, the kit that I used, I was pretty confident that it was all going to get used, that it was all pretty good kind of lightweight kit, really. And by splitting up the food element and to a certain extent fuel, but I'll probably talk a little more about the sort of stove and the fuel and everything in a minute, but by breaking down the food into these sort of 2 or 3 day periods, I never really had to carry that much food, really. Mm. So I think in total the weight of the rucksack is probably about 9-10k, something like
perfect.
That. Yeah, so yeah. That and I don't think I could have got away with much less.
And being safe, obviously.
Yeah. That's right. But much more. One of the reasons why I was reluctant to be too generous to myself, if you like, and pack too much in, is there are a few sections of road running on this route. And the fell running shoes have got no through sole, no sort of cushioning. And I was conscious of the fact that if I'd put a bit too much weight in the rucksack, those road running sections could have left me with quite a problem. As it is, I did sort of start to develop a bit of knee trouble. It was just because of the road sections, but a small price to pay for. Totally sort of unsupported. Solo trip. Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll come on to kit and the reason for your choices towards the end of the podcast, if we may, and actually get back to the trip itself. Now, I always visualise the Hebrides to be luxuriously alone and also exclusively expensive to get to. But you were saying that actually it was very, very affordable.
Oh, yeah. I took the car to Oban and a foot passenger on the ferry from Oban.
Well, first of all, can I just ask about parking the car? Because that's a fairly unique thing as well.
Yeah, Oban, you can pay a lot of money to park in Oban, but it's pretty well supplied with very secure parking that costs nothing at all. So I parked outside the swimming pool, which is a pretty popular place for people to park, while going over to the islands for several days. And Yeah, no problem at all. I was quite happy to leave the car there, and it was all in one piece when
free parking. Free parking. You heard it here, folks.
Yeah,
no, it's unique. So yeah, so a foot passenger over from Oban then.
Yeah, so foot passenger from Oban
to
Barra.
Find out how easy it is to subscribe to all our free programmes. Visit our website at theoutdoorstation.co.uk or look us up on Facebook.
Barra is the biggest island of at the southern end of the Outer Hebrides. It's a cluster of smaller islands, and Barra is the biggest of this sort of cluster of islands. The fare, it wasn't much. I think it was about £12, something like that. And it's needless to say, it is a fantastic ferry journey as well.
I was in Scotland doing the TGO at the beginning of May, and I remember specifically just how good the weather was at that particular part in this year, 2016. Mm. It had been quite a mild winter, or the winter. The effect of the winter had dissipated, and it was actually quite a mild crossing. So I presume you were in the same sort of situation with the weather for this particular trip, were you?
It was an interesting week and a bit for weather. Interesting in that I had quite a lot of clear weather, but because of the way that all the sort of low-pressure systems and everything was sitting, there was a lot of northerly air coming down across the islands. So there was some really cold and very, very strong winds. And on two sections of ridge, it was hands and knees. I was scuttling along on my hands and knees, wondering if I was ever going to finish this trip, if it was going to be like this all the way. I thought,
I have to say, with the few times it's happened to me in Scotland, it doesn't have to take you by surprise. All of a sudden, the last 10, 15 metres, and it just picks up.
Yeah, and although I didn't have a huge rucksack on, a
certain feeling of vulnerability.
Yeah, it feels like you're strapped to a bit of a wrecking ball, really, when the wind's really going for it. And of course, the Outer Hebrides, the first piece of land that winds from the west and the northwest hit after having travelled a long way without anything to interrupt them. So this is why, I said before, I was keen to go for a time of year where I'm likely to see less severe weather, particularly the winds, because it can be game over quite easily up here.
And I suppose you have to, when you do something like this, even after all the planning and preparation and you got there and you're happy, you have to accept that if that is going to be game over and the weather front changes, then you just have to accept it.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the pieces of kit that I had, which was just fantastic, is a tiny radio. So, it's not the most conventional piece of equipment, but this tiny radio just was, and I've carried it on all sorts of trips of this nature over the years, and it's just a great thing to have. Not just because sometimes it's quite nice to have a few voices twittering away at the end of the tent. You can get the shipping forecast. And I can just about translate the shipping forecast gibberish into something meaningful. And there was one wild camp, one night up on North Uist, where I got a bit of reception on this radio, and I'm listening to the shipping forecast. I thought, tomorrow is going to be awful. Tomorrow was going to be a day of everything. Every type of weather really was going to be crammed in. But fortunately, I wasn't far from a hostel up on the island of Bernarea, which is a gorgeous hostel. So I just wrote the day off and just sat in the hostel. And sure enough, out the window, it was really kicking off. But I was quite happy. And my feet were quite happy to have a day off as well.
Absolutely. So. Right, come on, let's get back to this trip now. These maps, these documents of danger, as you say. Now, looking at Barra there, that particular route you picked across the ridge, which is obviously a fairly exposed ridge, can't be more than, 12K, something like that, when you get into Castle Bay, is it?
Yeah.
So was that one day?
That was half a day, really.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, that was half a day. It's just the first day of this trip was always going to be a little bit of a disjointed affair, because as the time taken on the ferry crossing is something like 4 or 5 hours. But part of the trip, fantastic porpoises and dolphins and, you know, these open sea birds, puffins and things. So great. But it chews into the day somewhat. And then I had and then we can see on the map here, there's a small ferry to go from Barra to the next island. And the timing of that ferry was something that I had to work around as well. So what I had was an afternoon, really, to get across Barra and find somewhere to camp next to the ferry terminal at the north end of Barra to get the ferry first thing next morning to go over onto the next island.
Well, that's very impressive, because, I mean, you're obviously coming in at sea level, and that first peak there, am I reading that right, it's 383?
Yeah.
383 metres?
Yeah, that was quite a...
This is a bit of a steep climb.
Yeah, it is.
in what, less than half a kilometre?
Oh, I remember it well. I remember... That was quite a... After having spent 5 hours sort of with my feet up on this ferry, within 5 minutes of jumping off the ferry... Suddenly, oh, this isn't a holiday, is it? This is something else. But at least what I knew, and you know, you can see this because you're looking at the contours, is once that initial, it's the joy of all ridge routes, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Once that initial bit of huffing and puffing is out of the way, then it's a fairly gently undulating ridge, south to north. Not too bad at all, really. And then just drop down off the north. And a splendid little sea sort of inlet thing next to the ferry. So I pitched my tent, got some tea on, looking out the door of the tent, and a couple of otters just splashing around, doing what otters do, just picking crabs and things out of them. It was just... It certainly made up for the toil of the first hill on Barra, but it was great, and watched the sun go down. And
One thing I must mention, actually, obviously, people listening to this, you will want to see the photographs, and I think you put together a little video as well of the trip. So I'll put all the links to this in the show notes, because the pictures will complete the whole package when you see that, listening to what you've got to say on that score. So what time was your ferry the following day? And then where does that take you to?
The ferry the next day was quite early. That was 7 o'clock, I think. Yeah, so I was up kind of 6 o'clock, something like that. The usual procedure, shoving everything in the rucksack. I'll sort of find it if I need it, sort of approach, really.
Okay.
And then on the ferry, nice little, as you can see here on the map, the ferry goes past a few islands. Next island is Eriskay.
And so, how much was the ferry again?
Oh, that was a couple of quid, I think.
Oh, my word.
Two or three, yeah.
And time, just as to give people an idea?
So the ferry from Barra across to Eriskay was about an hour, I think. Yeah, I think it was an hour and a bit, something like that. So just long enough to enjoy, really.
A matter of interest, I mean, this is the first big island, I suppose, from Oban that you can get to, as you say, as a foot passenger. Did you mingle or associate or see or chat to anybody else doing anything similar while camping?
On Barra, I didn't. I just got straight into it. At points along the way, I met people when I dropped down onto the road to get food in the co-ops and things. I met a lot of people who were cycling the route.
Right.
So there's a south to north route, the Hebridean Way, I think it is, which is very popular with cyclists. But they were cursing it this May because of this unusual northerly pattern to the winds. So they were battling headwinds
all the way.
Yeah, so I really felt for them. So Eriskay is the... that would be about 8:30, something like that. So 8:30 in the morning, I arrived at Eriskay. So now I don't need a ferry for the next few days, because from Eriskay, so I went up through there's this very small hill on Eriskay. Fantastic views from the hill out across Barra and all of the very southern tip of the Outer Hebrides. So there's a grandstand view from Benskiathen on Eriskay. Then dropping off of that, there's a short section of Causeway where a road has been built which connects Eriskay to South Uist. So I had a little bit of road running, and then what was that? That's a sort of a kilometre and a half, something like that, and then back into the hills, which is nice. Yeah, and that's me on the on South Uist, which is great because that's now I can get stuck into a good few days of uninterrupted sort of hill time without any ferries or anything like that. So I was really looking forward to getting onto South Uist, really get my teeth into the trip, really.
So I presume you've had one day, one night, that's well, half a day really, if that, to get round to the hills. You haven't needed to pick any supplies up or anything?
No. Still very sort of self-sufficient. It's just as well, because I don't think there were any shops.
But, okay, so let's just change the maps then.
Okay.
Right, so we've got the length of an OS map now ahead of us. So take us through these couple of days.
Yeah, it's a very varied couple of days, really. So at the south of this map, we're on South Uist, which is a real joy for the hill walker, because the hills, as you can see, they all line up to create this fantastic ridge, and it's a very sinuous ridge, so you have to be careful. So I had a few patches of bad visibility on this ridge, so it's not difficult to take a sort of outlying sort of subsidiary ridge and find that you're off route. So definitely something to take very seriously.
Looking at the height of these, though, and certainly the contours, which are very, very close together, you're looking right on the knife edge. Did you have much snow? Was there much snow to have to deal with? Because I didn't see anywhere we were.
No, I think they did have a little bit of snow during the winter, but on the Western Isles, when the snow comes in, it disappears as quickly as it arrives. Okay. Because it's very... I think the pattern is usually a little bit of a northwesterly will bring some snow in, and then a westerly comes in and it's just warm and damp. So no snow patches or anything to deal with. South Uist, fantastic ridge, which as you can see is cut in by at least one sea loch, which is actually a thing called a fjord, which is a sort of very shallow fjord. I don't know.
Is that where you camped then, second night?
No, the next night was actually, it was just in here, I think.
Oh, so you camped fairly high then? It wasn't a case of, taking in the view of the loch and sort of camping down the loch side?
It was all about making the best use of the days.
Right.
And I think if it looked as though the end of a day would correspond with a nice sort of loch side camping spot, then I'd go for it, because they are, and there are one or two spots where I was able to do that, and they're superb places to wild camp.
Yeah, I mean, that instantly comes to mind is, what was your time of a day? What would you class as the end of a day for a practical point of view?
The end of a day, my days were about 7 hours long, say seven maybe 8 hours on a long day.
So four-ish, five-ish.
That's right.
So once you got onto that ridge, that must have been magnificent, past Ben Moore.
Yeah, well, Ben Moore is as you can see from the contours here, it's a real knife-edged ridge, and that was a hands and knees job for quite a lot of that, because on the east side of that ridge is a set of heroic cliffs, just huge cliffs, and not somewhere to go for a tumble, really. So and there's a very delicate path weaving through a few pinnacles up there, and rock pinnacles, very sort of, it's kind of borderline scrambling really up there. I was on hands and knees for a while up there, and then dropping down quite a long way, actually. I'd forgotten how far that was down before then going back up again on Ben Corridil. And then Hecla is a fantastic mountain. Hecla is at the north end of the main ridge of hills on South Uist. And I was quite lucky in the visibility that I had on Hecla because, and I'm always very, very keen to make myself turn around and have a look at where I've just come from on a ridge walk or a scramble or something. And on Hecla, that was well worth doing because, you know, as you can imagine by looking at this map, the view southwards was just, you just couldn't drink it in, really. There was, and the view stretched all the way down to Barra and beyond.
We were talking before we started the recording, and I mean, we both commented on sometimes that people get so hooked on speed of achieving a challenge or a goal that they actually forget to appreciate where they are and take in where they've come from.
Oh, absolutely. And again, as we were saying, one of the reasons why I was quite keen to do this trip is an extension of the more time-critical adventure racing events is that I have a very hazy memory of many of the landscapes that I've been through on mountain marathon events, which seems like a shame, really, but not surprising because the sort of focus of the trip is all about orienteering and getting there before the course closes and this sort of thing. But what I was very keen to do on this trip to the Outer Hebrides, was to use that sort of apprenticeship, if you like, as a way of helping me to cover a big area in a workable period of time, but to relax the pressure so that the start and finish of each day, none of that was predetermined. So I could be completely relaxed. There were a few shorter days and there were a few much, much longer days. But I could use my own judgment. And on a couple of the shorter days were made short because I just spent a lot of time taking photographs and looking at wildflowers and things.
I'm sure everybody's going to look forward to seeing those. Yeah, so what was your day? Where did you finish? That's quite a big ridge. I mean, I would anticipate finishing around here somewhere, but yeah, where else did you finish that day?
I think it was in here somewhere.
Which is like a sort of an area of fjords or mini fjords, isn't it?
It's more of a kind of bogland, which sounds, to an ecologist, the word bog brings great excitement, bizarre as it may sound. But no, these are all fantastic areas of peat bog. So, and one of the special things about the areas of blanket bog, the peat bog on Uist, is it has a resident, well, in terms of nesting birds, so we have populations of geese that choose to breed on the Outer Hebrides that would otherwise migrate up to the Arctic Circle to breed. So these are birds of tundra landscapes. And so even in the summer in the Outer Hebrides, we've got something which is more tundra-like than anything else. So the huge numbers of quite a variety of different sort of Arctic Circle bird species on all of these little lochs, and some really, really rare things, you know, red-throated divers and black-throated divers, grey-legged geese, white-fronted geese. Yeah, it's very... I do remember, actually, yes, this is an area where I wildcat, because one of the pieces of kit I took was a very small pair of binoculars. So... but a crucial piece of kit, I think, because I was just really getting into the sort of bird life of these loch systems.
Part two of David's trip will follow very soon. My thanks to him and our executive producer, Mark Cole, for their contributions to this show. Once again, when you visit the Outdoor Station to view the pictures associated with this podcast, please take a few moments to join our newsletter list. You'll not want to miss out when the time comes, I assure you. So I leave you with this final thought from Beverly Sills. There are no shortcuts to any place worth going. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorstation.co.uk.